Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 163, being recorded on the 25th of Jan, 2017. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have, of course, Kale and Evan. And it's good to be back, three of us again. Now, we haven't done one of these in a while.
Yep.
And I'm going to say you guys did a very good job last week with the show. Came out very nice. So.
Thank you. I got to say your intro is still better.
No, you guys, it was a very nice topic with Matt. I heard it. Very, very cool stuff. So, this week we've got quite a few updates that kind of popped up, and interestingly, a bunch of them are in the blockchain space and some in the SQL space. So I'm going to let those respective folks talk about them.
Go ahead, Evan. You go first.
Well, I'm going to talk about blockchain today. So, no, just kidding.
Hey, you got to confuse everybody now.
Yeah, exactly. This actually was both of these are cool for different reasons. Depending on how long you've been around the Azure SQL database space, you'll remember back, I guess this was in the Silverlight portal days, we had kind of this little ability to run run queries against your SQL database from within the Azure portal. You didn't have to spin up Management Studio and the like, which we haven't had for a little while. And so we've released that now in the Azure portal, so you have the ability to go and run your queries now, which, again, 90% of what you're going to do is you're probably going to be sitting in Management Studio or Visual Studio kind of doing, higher-end SQL managing your database. But the, anytime if I'm at, somebody else's computer and I just need to go check something, now I can just do it right within the portal, right? I don't need to install anything to check some data. So I thought that was great. I was actually surprised it wasn't there still when I was looking for it.
Do you know, Evan, I don't know much about this feature. Is that something where, is it possible to actually run it from a management script then, like without using any other thing? Like we could actually hit an API to do a SQL query? I don't know if it's true.
No, that's a good question. I'm actually not sure from an underlying implementation layer whether we expose those APIs to end users. But, I will make a note and I will go find out. Because that's a really good question. The other thing that was out there is some new T-SQL string functions. And, again, these are kind of, I don't want to say esoteric string functions because I know there are people that use them, but, 90% of us are, or 99% of us are out doing the, you're doing just a left and a right and that kind of stuff, and a concatenate. But these allow you to do things like aggregate strings from a table, multiple rows from a table into a common delimited result, or vice versa, right? You can kind of break that stuff apart. But the thing that really struck me about this is if you go look at the documentation for this, and I had to look at it twice to read it, because what it says at the top of the documentation, it says SQL Server vNext and SQL Azure. So this is, again, a feature that SQL Azure already has, and on-premises SQL Server will have it, in whatever the next version is.
Wow.
I know this thing seems small. Yeah, those things seem small, but I remember years back shredding data to put it in a database when it was in like CSV format. It was like, okay, now we have to have a write a function, and we got to figure out how we're going to do that.
That's what I mean. I mean, if you need it, you absolutely need this functionality. Again, most of us have gone, years and years where you just have other ways to do it. But so it is pretty cool text functionality. But again, the part that I thought was awesome was yet again we have, a scenario where SQL Azure is getting something first.
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more of that. So
it's just easier to ship that stuff, right? Because we ship it once and everybody has it instead of having to ship a update and everybody has to install it, right? I mean, it's great. So,
well, thanks for that. Kale, what's this project manifest all about?
Yeah, so there's for those in the retail space, there's basically a NRF conference.
NRF is
National Retail something. It's basically like one of the biggest retail conferences in the world that happened, I think it was last week, in New York. And so York, who's part of our team, you know, they kind of unveiled this project manifest, which is kind of a plan around how we do and manage things like RFID and IoT devices in retail space using blockchain, like how we're starting to integrate those pieces. So it's a pretty cool partnership there because Mojix is one of the partners we're working with there. And for those in the space would know, those guys are really large in that area. Like things like when you walk out of a store and the little things, tags on there to make sure you aren't stealing clothing and things like that, that's part of them. So they have some pretty deep technology already embedded in this space and very excited about, you know, blockchain aspects from a supply chain management standpoint.
Good.
So
very nice.
So Kale, maybe, and maybe, again, we were just talking before we started today that we're going to have to come back and do some more blockchain stuff to kind of lay out some of the real world scenarios. But, you know, the one you just talked about in that kind of retail scenario, how does blockchain, what does blockchain bring, or how does that add to that scenario?
I think there's a couple different angles. I'll talk about probably the most popular one would be like a track and trace scenario. So if you think about us, the Surface product, obviously we don't build everything that's inside of that Surface, right? Parts are sourced from all over the world. The screen technology may come from a certain area. Some of the chips are coming from different regions of the world. All these pieces are coming together, and you can imagine that's quite a complex operation to manage, bringing all those pieces together, you know, and then the whole chain up to the point where we actually produce a device and it gets sold. But if you think about what's happening there is, let's just say there's five companies involved there. Each one of those is building their unique item component that's going to go into there. And if we can establish provenance for that on something like a blockchain or a distributed ledger technology, then basically we can kind of prove where that is. But it goes beyond that.
Oh, okay. I got you.
That's an aspect. I don't think that's the biggest one. The biggest part is the shared database aspect of it, if you think of it like that. Because in the real world today, these systems, if you had five companies, there's at least five databases involved there, probably many, many more. Yep. And what's happening is we build crazy integration, EDI, all these different like interconnects between businesses to be able to basically keep them in sync about what's happening. If you think about a blockchain, and from a logical sense, it's a single database. So we're all feeding into the same thing. So we can all just basically real-time go, wait a second, something happened in Japan with these chips, so this batch is bad. Okay, who's affected? Boom,
you got that
database and see it right away. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, Kale, I remember they used to use BizTalk server used to be very popular with those kind of scenarios, right? With the EDI and things like that in the past.
Still are, you know, it's just, we just think this might be an evolution where blockchain can provide value.
Cool. And so speaking of trying to get up to speed with blockchain, our buddy Kale put together a cool MVA course. Kale, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, just a few minutes. I mean, we'll put a link in the link dump, but myself and Derek Martin, who's a CSA for Microsoft and does a lot of work with blockchain, we basically put together five modules, and this is more, think of this more as like a kind of a beginner's kind of getting up to speed with it. Plans are to kind of do a more advanced one with a bit lower level detail, but kind of walk you through, like, we basically have five modules, three sections to each. One is like a theory to explain what's happening. Then we do like an architecture session in front of a Surface Hub, kind of draw out what's happening here. And then we do an actual hands-on demo. So check it out.
That's cool. So just moving on to some of the other services, Event Hubs is something that we've talked about in the past. And now, I guess, you know, Event Hubs, you could really get a lot of traffic into that. And there's been a need for having a more dedicated offering for Event Hubs as opposed to the current shared offering where, you know, you're a tenant in the Event Hub system. And so now if you feel you've got high enough volume, you could ask for a dedicated infrastructure for Event Hub, which essentially guarantees that any capacity that you need for any kind of burst that you're expecting, it can handle it up to 2 million events per second, which is kind of mind-boggling.
That's huge.
I know, yeah. I can't even imagine who would send or what application would send that much data in, but it can handle, I guess if you have like a whole lot of actual users, you know, browsers, etc., sending in telemetry data and all that stuff, it could be pretty high. But yeah, so that's something new that came up. And then kind of also in the SQL space, somewhat related is, data warehousing is something that's pretty common if you have a SQL Server database. But the problem is that data warehousing, essentially, you got to write code for it, right? And in the past, there have been scripts or some sort of a code to do the transforms. You know, you have the ADF, the Data Factory, Azure Data Factory job. It's all code at the end of the day. We had this talk once, I forget who, gentleman in Europe, about infrastructure as code. And so eventually, everything's code. And so when you have code, you want to think of things in terms of continuous integration, right? And coming from a developer's perspective, when we think of code, we think of CI, right? Being able to check in stuff. It goes through a bunch of build scripts, and it gets deployed, and you can test it and get a feedback kind of immediately, right, whether your stuff is good. And so they're trying to do the same thing for data warehousing now, right? So they do make an ADF change, for example, or some sort of a script change. They can check it in. It'll go through a process where it'll get deployed. You know, it'll get you can run some tests on it, and you can get some feedback as to whether it's good. Then you can deploy into production automatically, you know, if those tests are successful. So it's exactly what we do today in the .NET or ASP.NET or Java, JavaScript worlds, you can now do with data warehousing, which I think is pretty nice.
That's really cool. I saw that one other one there about the management libraries. We had someone on in recent history here talking about that, and I think there's been some more enhancements there. That stuff looks really cool, by the way, for those who are writing small amounts of code to deploy that stuff. It looks like very elegant the way they have that wired up now, where you can basically, it's similar to JavaScript, right? We can basically just kind of tag on to it functions, almost like anonymous functions at the end of it, and to create all the pieces. Yeah.
The fluent syntax, right? I think, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
And it's the same guy, Asser. I think he was the guy who came on, I think, on our show, and he has this blog item which we'll put up there. I think that's the one you're referring to, right, Kale?
Yeah.
Where you have now, you can now manage the app server, SQL database, and other things through the Azure Management Libraries. So, just expanding the number of services that you can manage to that. Cool. Okay. Anything else, or shall we just get on to our topic of the day today? I think that's about it.
Let's get on the topic. I think this is a really interesting one here.
So, Kale, you had this was your kind of your brainchild. So, why didn't you lay it out for us?
Yeah. No, I had seen this pop up just recently in some of the Azure blogs about VM internals, and kind of when I read through it, it kind of struck a chord with me that, you know, maybe sometimes things we take for granted or things that we just like assume people know, they don't because it's just not something they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And so that's what I was, the inspiration here was basically a series of things that happen based on how the platform has evolved. You know, we went from ASM to ARM, and I think in general, if people are using Azure, they're probably going to stumble into that at least at some point, understanding what ARM means and what that means. But underneath it, you know, that's kind of like a front-end layer type thing. That's what people would get exposed to them through scripts or management libraries or whatever. But at a lower level, you know, when you hear things like CRP and NRP and SRP and these different resource providers, I think maybe sometimes we take it for granted and we just lay it out, oh, that's not on SRP, that can't work. And people are like, what's that mean? I don't know. You're speaking a different language now. So I thought it might make sense to kind of delve into this a little bit. And just from that standpoint, I think, you know, from the ARM standpoint, and Evan, feel free to jump in. I'm sure you're way beyond us on this one, but the resource provider model of, you know, the compute network and storage, as I was mentioning those abbreviations before, is kind of the lowest level for these providers, how they're implemented inside Azure to do these different things for us.
Yeah, no, it's actually, and one small correction. So this same data, the kind of things we're looking at here, do exist with classic VMs. It's just not nearly as segmented. Right, it's not broken down into the kind of individual resource providers like we were talking about, storage, compute, network. And actually, every product has its own resource provider, SQL resource provider. And there's probably an event hub one. We were talking about event hubs. But, yeah, I mean, this really allows us to really get rich data, and each layer calls to each other. Right, so you have clearly defined interfaces between them, which really makes tracking some of these problems down much easier than it was in the past.
Yeah, I think the other thing that this brings, that you know, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and I was telling them about, okay, when we spin some things up here in Azure, like we're going to spin up this whole cluster of things, a bunch of VMs, a network, you know, a load balancer, a bunch of other things, you know, NSGs and these kind of things. And we get all this stuff spun up, and I was like, okay, so I just want to let you guys know, like, well, once you spin this up, you take a look at it, don't leave that run, you know, forever, because obviously there's cost there, right, to running all these things. We were doing some testing and whatnot. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to have to figure out how to clean that up. And then I was like, it's in a resource group. All we do is delete the resource group and let it do its thing. It'll go figure out how to delete those things and do it on. Like, oh, yeah, yeah, I forgot about that. So I'd love to call out, like, you know, especially when you're doing deployments and whatnot. I think we talked about this a lot in the past, but it's something maybe people should remember that, you know, as long as you keep them segmented that way, it's really easy if you're doing temporary things to clean up.
Yeah, if you go look at my subscription, it's littered with, you know, RG, you know, test this, RG test that, RG this. You know, kind of like the old test.txt that everybody has floating around their machines. I've got all these resource groups. Because you're right. You know, I go, oh, that's resource group, you know, test last week. Oh, I can blow that away. I don't have to care what's underneath it. Right? It's just gone.
But on the same note, I've seen people, and I've seen this at a Hackfest one time, where people put everything in one resource group, and then they're like, okay, we're going to clean that up. Oh, wait, after they deleted it, oh, I forgot that was in there. Like,
so this is where export your templates, and then you can get it all back.
Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword there. You got to be careful.
True. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think the nice thing, you know, you guys are right. I mean, I look at this kind of data on a regular basis, but I thought what was really nice about this article is Eunice goes through, you know, kind of some of the underlying data and translates it to, you know, what it really means, right? You know, he talks about showing, you know, here's the definition for the OS disk. Well, it's just a blob, a VHD sitting in blob storage, and he breaks down, you know, where the blob is. You know, and looking at some of the logs that go with it, you know, kind of different ways to look at this data. Now, have you guys ever kind of looked real closely at, and, you know, he walks through an agent configuration failure. Have you guys ever tried to troubleshoot one of those before?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Sajid go, but I mean, I do that all the time because the partners that I work with almost always, at least in dev, when we're spinning these things up, it's always a script. We always have an extension there running some script, and then invariably that thing fails or something happens, and then we're digging through trying to figure out, like, where did it fail, which piece failed, like all those pieces.
Yeah, and it's like, imagine doing that without these logs.
Yeah.
Right. Without this data, go through and figure it's just, you know, so we've actually done a really good job. Now we dump a whole lot more information in those logs than we used to. So it's a lot easier to figure out. Still not, you know, super simple sometimes. But there's a lot of really good detailed information. It's kind of where you should always start is looking in these agent logs.
Well, I'm working with a customer now, and they're really taking, you know, customizing these VM images to the extreme. Mm-hmm. They'll start with the base image, and then they'll put like a whole bunch of things like antivirus software, you know, some kind of a Splunk agent, this agent, that agent, you know, all the third party software that they've collected, and so, you know, to get it ready for production. So they wind up having to do a whole lot of steps, and you're right, any one of those steps could fail, right? And
yep.
you want to figure out, you want to understand at the end of that provisioning process whether the machine is in a healthy state for you to go get going.
Yep.
And if it's not, then you take it out of rotation, you know, put it on the side, and someone comes in and takes a look and see, okay, what failed on this machine? It's typically a kind of, you're provisioning maybe a farm or a few machines at a time, maybe in a VM scale set or something like that. So this is something that's very, very useful, having this kind of information. And I'm glad that they highlighted in the blog.
Yeah, the other thing that I would encourage people when you look at this stuff, because what I think goes hand in hand with it is the deployment logs that you can see in the portal, right? Actually, you know, you can get them through PowerShell as well. But when you put those together with these kind of agent logs on the machine, man, you can really, it's much, much easier to try and track down, you know, what actually failed on this stuff. I'm working on one right now where I was getting a domain join failure. And the portal tells me, yeah, you know, domain join extension fails. Okay, that's not super useful. but when I look in the logs, it says, hey, you know, can't find my domain controller. Well, it's because I had messed up my DNS settings. Right? But I never would have figured that out from just the deployment data. Right? I needed the additional logs that the agent extension spits out as it does this.
Yeah, another aspect I see that we use a lot in stuff that I'm working with and people could take advantage of, and I think it's a bit hidden. So when you start working with ARM templates, and you know, typically you can come in and build something and then export the template and tweak it a bit to do what you need, or go to the GitHub repo that has a million different examples and steal one of those and kind of tweak it. But some of the cool things that we've been doing, because you know, if it's just a operating system and installing it on a machine, it's kind of boring. But if we're saying, okay, well, we're going to put more things on that, like Sajid's talking about, we're going to start scripting things and putting other pieces into there. One of the things you can do, if it's more advanced, is remember the output section in the ARM template. So when you do that, what's cool is it basically, based on what happens when you're spinning up your virtual machines, maybe some of the configuration values you'll need later, if it's like an application that's installed and there's some sort of key or something inside of there or an IDE that you need later, we use this a lot in blockchain. Basically, you can spit that out in the output side. And then what's cool is, like, after the VM's spinning up, you can go into the deployment to your thing, Evan, go into the deployment logs, and right there it shows you the output, like, in a nice GUI, and you can see right away, oh, okay, here's my network ID, or here's this thing that I needed for something else later, you know.
Oh, I did not know you could do that. I might use that to troubleshoot some of the ARM template I'm trying to work on.
Yeah, we use that a lot, because there's a lot of parameters that chains create on the fly that we need later, you know.
Yeah, you define them, right, but you don't really know what the value is until runtime.
Yep.
So, yeah, no, that's cool. So now we're talking about these scripts and these, you know, kind of agent stuff, but I will say in ARM templates are kind of built on are predicated on the mindset of declarative, right? I'm declaring what I want my end result to be, platform, go figure it out. The other thing, don't forget, you know, that you can also use desired state config on both the Linux and the Windows VMs, right, to drive what you want the guest OS to be, how you want it to be configured, as well as, you know, these things at the platform level. Don't forget about that capability, because that, again, that takes the kind of order of things out of your hands. You don't have to worry about it. You tell the OS, this is what I want you to be like when you're done. Go figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that separates. It's like an architecture magic thing, like figuring out how much to bake into the image, how much to put in DSC, how much to put in the script. I mean, I think that's like a black art almost to get it right, you know, to have something super optimal, you know.
So actually, that's a good point, Guy. What's the example of something that you would put, like, let's say you're setting up a simple app server, right, an ESP.NET app server. What's an example of something that you would put in DSC and something that you would put into the agent script or something like that?
I don't know. I mean, I can give examples of things we've done, at least from my experience. I mean, you guys maybe have differing ones, but definitely like DSC, if it's something that's a core component on the machine, like a web server or something like that of that nature, especially on Windows, something like IaaS and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think those work super awesome with DSC. The script stuff I've used where it feels like things are a little bit off the rails a little bit, with, like, not bad meaning, but it's something like total custom I want to do, that I might have to kind of jump through some hoops. I'm pretty sure I could still do it in DSC, but it might be easier for me to manage and version a script to do that if it's going to get revved at a different interval or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of my take on it as well. The one that I'm actually working on, a full O365 deployment, you know, ADFS, you know, web application proxy, DC, and there I'm trying to strike that same exact balance that Kale's talking about. So ADFS is a Windows feature, you know, domain controller is a Windows feature. You know, I'm trying to push everything I can in DSC because it's kind of core Windows functionality, but once I get to the point of, you know, doing AD Connect and configuring my ADFS server, that I can't do with DSC. Right. That I'm going to have to do kind of a, I'm probably going to do some mix of chocolatey and just a custom script, you know, things that to do it. But
so if you need to call some utility or something like that, then you're going to have to script it out.
Probably. Yeah. Something that really doesn't have a, I mean, something, these applications have to kind of know about the state engine, or the state engine has to know about them.
Right.
And if it doesn't, you know, then yeah, you absolutely have to do custom stuff at that point.
The other thing to keep in mind along with that, and even another wrinkle now, is the ARMS thing. So if you took all that and said, okay, we're going to have a baked image, or maybe not a baked image, but we're going to do a lot of dynamic, like DSC script stuff, is the fact that, you know, like the published images, like let's say from Microsoft, like Windows or Linux or one of those that gets published out there, the I guess they would be canonical or something of that nature. But when they get pushed out, there's actually like a version in there in the ARM template. So you can actually like, you know, kind of tweak that as well to say, don't just grab the latest of whatever's up there. Actually use this specific one when you spin up these instances.
Yep. Yeah, now we're kind of talking on templates, you know, beyond the internals. But I think they're so intimately tied.
Yeah.
I mean, you can even do copies of objects. I mean, there's a lot of power to this. To this model, but it, you know, again, to bring it back to where we started, right? All this is enabled because we have these resource providers, right? Where you can, you know, again, say, hey, I want to define my NIC, my, you know, which is a part of the network resource provider, as this definition, totally independent from the virtual machine, right? Yep. Same with my disk. I'm just defining my disk, you know, that the storage resource provider knows how to build that disk, and then, you know, right before we kind of tie, you know, at the end we tie everything in and say, hey, this disk goes with this virtual machine, this NIC goes with this virtual machine. But the storage resource provider has no idea and doesn't have to care about the compute resource provider, the virtual machine aspect. You know, same with the NIC. They don't really have to, they share information, but they don't have to talk to each other necessarily to do their own work.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I'd say one of the other pieces that comes up a fair amount that I see is when people are cloning machines. Mm-hmm. That becomes always, you know, if someone's doing it for the first time, they usually kind of stumble a little bit, at least from my experience, on things like, okay, I prepped my machine. So I've done the typical thing, let's say it's Windows, we're doing a sysprep, right? So we go ahead and generalize the machine. We have it configured the way we want. And then I shut it down, but there's still a lease on the blob. There's still these other things to think about. And then there's also the aspect of how do I, you know, how can I use that thing? I don't know if people know this, but like if you're in like, let's say the East US 2 data center, which is near and dear to my heart, you know, if you build your image and put it there and then try to instantiate a VM in a different region, you'll quickly see that you need to have that thing replicated there. So that's something to keep in mind when you're saying, oh, I'm just going to go ahead and start using that image all across the world. No, you're not. You're going to be copying that over there first. And, you know, thinking about things that, you know, you don't even think you take for granted at first. You say, oh, crap, well, I need that on the West Coast. So how do I get it over there? What's the easiest way? I mean, for, again, I don't know if we take this for granted, but some people may try to pull that VHD down and then push it up there. And these things are typically 30, 40 gigs or something. That's big. You know, it can take a lot of time. Using AZCopy and SAS tokens, which gets into a whole other kind of thing about when you build a SAS token, how do you make sure it's shared correctly, like which attributes? And I mean, for me, we used to use the old storage tool that came out there first that was on Windows, but the newest one, if you just go to storageexplorer.com, I think it is, that one is awesome. I mean, the other one was great, but this one is just, you know, it's cross-platform, so it works on any modern OS, and you can basically just go in and generate a SAS token and check boxes and say, I want this thing like this, and pull it out.
Yeah, I like Azure Storage Explorer. I've been playing with that as well, so totally agreed.
The new one, is that what you're planning using?
Yeah, the multi-platform one.
Yeah.
I think the name's Azure Storage. Some combination of Azure and Storage Explorer. I can't remember the order.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's I mean, the old one was kind of starting to go down the wayside. It wasn't being updated and whatnot. So this one's
was
a welcome update. So I was looking at this blog item that Kale was talking about, and interestingly, how it kind of gives you a nice kind of under the covers look as to what happens in a VM, right? I mean, so we all know we provision a VM and it has all these resources, a network, as you mentioned, a hard disk and things like that. But actually, you could just make a call like to the resource provider using the REST interface, and it'll give you information, and it gives you a lot of under the covers information as to what makes up that VM, right? For example, one thing they talk about is the disk itself, the OS disk itself. You know, you can pull it down and it gives you the full URL for the OS disk, right? Which is the, I guess, the C drive, right? In most Windows VMs, for example, and you can get all details about it, you know, where it's located and things like that. So, some nice correlation between by using that Cloud Explorer, so you could look at the native blob of that particular VM.
Yep. Yeah. Everything's JSON properties, right? So, yeah. So when you pull that definition down, that you are literally defining all the pieces and parts of that virtual machine. Then it's just a function of kind of where you see it and where you show it. I mean, everything's HTTP under the covers these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can define it, but consequently, you can also get it, right? So if you go to the to the portal and you create it using the GUI, you may not know about what went into it, but then subsequently you can say, you know, hey, give me the definition for this VM, and this is going to give you that that JSON document back, kind of the way that you might have created in the first place, but it's going to give it to you, and it's got all the details in it, you know, of the underlying network and things like that.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Go ahead, Evan.
Yeah, I was just saying, and that's, I mean, when we talk about the DevOps piece, right? That is what you use when you're doing the DevOps, right? That's what you're keeping in your source control, is that kind of config.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes. Go ahead, Cal.
Yeah, no, I was just going to comment on the replication side again. I was talking about the SAS tokens. We do have that tool AZCopy to do server-side copies, which is kind of interesting if you're going between regions and those kind of things. But the other thing to keep in mind is we do have, you know, snapshotting capabilities. So remember, you got that one in your back pocket. I think, I don't know, it seems as the name just flew out of my head, the recovery services, as that thing matures, maybe the less manual work we have to do there. It seems like we had to do quite a bit of that before, where that tool wasn't quite as mature as it was now. Yeah. We would basically take snapshots, but we had to make sure we had consistency on the disk. So, I mean, it's something to keep in mind. I ran into this before where people have like a database, let's say it's maybe not even Microsoft product, but just a database running on a data disk and locking files on there and whatnot. And if obviously, like at the lowest level, we could take a snapshot of that disk and replicate it. But whether it's consistent or not, like whether the application can actually use it, it's a whole other story. So it became like this little dance of like, how do we kind of pause writes, or how do we put that in a consistent state so that we could take a snapshot, put it on another area, whatnot, and then bring it back up and have something that actually worked.
And then another nuance which they talk about here, which I have just realized that I've been violating this particular recommendation that they
so we have to kick you off the podcast here.
Sajid's boss is listening. This is a joke. That's not real.
No. When I say violate, I mean I have an Azure service that I have run on the side, and I've got two VMs set, right, an availability set.
Yep.
So what I've done is I have auto update enabled on both those VMs. Okay.
Right.
And it says over here clearly that if you have two or multiple VMs in an availability set, you don't want to have auto update turned on. Because auto update generally tends to reboot the machine kind of at some random time, right? Well, not random time, but you can never tell when it is, etc. And so that's something you're going to have to go back and fix, but that's a good tip right there.
Yeah, I think the problem is, right, when the reboot's triggered from within the guest, we actually see this pretty regularly because there's lots of ways you can run into this. I think we talked ways back about fault domains and update domains, which basically say within an availability set, you know, let's say you have two VMs, they're guaranteed to be in different update domains and they're guaranteed to be in different fault domains. Right, that way you always have one up at any given time. Well, Windows Update kicks in at the guest. And if the guest if the guest triggers a restart, the platform says, well, okay, you're restarting on your own. I'm not going to worry about whether or not, you know, the other side's up. That's the problem with the Windows update from that point. Yeah, so, I hadn't thought about Windows Update doing that because we do really recommend that people have Windows Update on for lots of other reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go do some digging and see if we've got some improvements planned so that Windows Update can kind of be platform aware. Because this feels like something that we don't want people to turn off Windows Update all the time.
I think back to the point earlier about like DSC, I mean, and I don't know the name of this product now because it's probably changed, but it used to be called SUS or WSUS. So if you're using one of those to manage these machines or your system center, I guess, I guess you're less at risk of this then, right? Because you're managing things a bit more.
You're controlling that at that point. Yep.
Yeah, there's a way you can script the update so it kind of takes it out of the availability set first in an orderly way. I suppose you could do it, but I don't know if that's a script or something that does that for you.
Yeah, I think that the trick here might be to, maybe set the updates to apply but not reboot or something like that, and then you come through and tell the platform to reboot the machine periodically.
Got it.
And that way the restart kicks in.
Yes.
But it's controlled at the platform level. Like I said, I'll do some digging on this and see kind of what we recommend as best practice to have both your updates and your availability sets, because I honestly don't know, but this feels like something we should have a recommendation about. So no, great. I hope your service doesn't go down tonight, Sajid.
I'm gonna have to fix that soon, though. What else you got over there, Kale? What else did you like in that?
I think that's pretty much it. I think Evan hit pretty good on the extensions, which is a whole kind of can of worms there. But it actually works really well. I mean, those things are a godsend, that we're able to actually inject code like that at runtime and have it actually build dependencies off of that thing too, so that we can kind of orchestrate how the build happens when there's multiple things happening at once.
Right.
That's amazing. I mean, if without that, it would be an absolute nightmare trying to script out all those things. And, I mean, just on the capture side, those are the things I typically run into about, the lease is hung up, somebody deallocated a machine, but they didn't actually delete it. There's a lock on the BHD, and then they're trying to share that out or do something with it and end up getting into issues there.
Did we talk about the boot diagnostics? We did, right?
No, actually, we didn't touch on it. You want to talk about those real
there
quick?
There's an interesting point about the boot diagnostics. So I think we all know, right, that it kind of shows you stuff that's happening when the VM's actually coming up, right, which typically you can only see if you're sitting in front of a machine, for example, because the RDP screen that we were used to, that only happens after the system is booted up. So if you want to be able to see the boot diagnostics, you could do it from the portal, but there's also a way you could do it from the command line if you're, for example, if you're scripting it for diagnostic purposes, right? If a machine failed to come up, and as part of your run book for that, you say, okay, I need to get a screenshot to see where this machine froze, right? Where is it on the boot screen? So there's a little utility, using the Azure command, the Node Azure Node applet. You can VM get serial output, and it'll show you the output of the serial interface, which is where what gets written to when the system is booting, and that'll have that little error, for example, unable to boot from the disk or whatever the error might be, right? And it saves that in an image location, which is just a URL, and now you can take that image and attach it to your trouble ticket or something like that, so that you can do some further debugging on that.
Yeah, Evan, without giving away any secrets or anything, is it possible, like, on a Windows system, like when we had Bare Metal a long time ago?
Yeah.
When we actually used Bare Metal machines?
What's that? I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
We used to be able to set, like, flags in the boot config for Windows, basically, and set it up in, like, debug mode, right, where it's going to pour out tons of debug output when it comes up, and actually we could attach serial cables and all that jazz. But, like, can you just still do that, like, in Azure? Does that work? Like, if we set a flag like that, does it pour more into this or
no,
not?
No, this is where Linux is. Linux, there's a ton of stuff that gets emitted on boot, right? Windows just, it's not built into Windows. I mean, you look at Windows history, right? Windows was designed originally to be kind of an interactive environment, and we still bring a lot of that kind of history with us, even in our server products. Right. So yeah, it's not nearly as rich from that. That's now on the other hand, we have really rich event logs and ETL logging, and I think that's where we're getting some of that similar information. But it's more at the guest level than at the platform. I mean, we can certainly use the platform to dump it into storage and make it easier to visualize and like, but it's really coming from the guest OS itself.
Yeah, I know. I've used these a lot on Linux systems because you can see exactly what's happening as it's booting, like the as it's all the pieces are initializing and whatnot. So
yeah, I will say that if there's a group of some of the folks that I work with, that the ability to have this kind of debug view on startup for Windows machines is probably their number one ask and has been their number one ask for I don't know how many years now. I think there's. I don't know for sure, but I believe we've got long-term plans to add it because it would make these scenarios easier. But man, that's a fundamental change in kind of some core Windows functionality. So that's big and risky and probably takes some time to do right. So it's coming eventually.
Cool.
All right. So that's a good roundup on those two blog items, and we'll put them in the show notes so that our listeners can get all the the utilities and scripts and etc. that the Peter talked about. They're all in there, and that's a good idea, Cale. Thanks for bringing that up. All right, so that wraps up the session for today, and we'll see you guys next week.
Sounds good.
See you guys.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.